Steinhaus from Albert Einstein Institute. He's going to tell us about path integral measure and triangulation independence in discrete gravity.
Thank you very much. And I would like to welcome everyone to my talk. And today I would like to talk to you about what you can learn about the path integral measure if you require triangulation independence in vector calculus. And this is work I finished last year with the on the archive and on FIS-FD. Before I go on, can everyone hear me? Is it clear? Okay, since I stay here, anyone, please go to the next slide, slide number two. So if you work in the covariant approach to quantum gravity, you are interested in the entity as written here in the middle of the slide, which is path integral, that's formally written for gravity, where you have some integral over the space, some measure, for which we have to give a meaning, and e to i, Einstein-Hilbert action. And in order to define this path integral non-perturbatively, you usually have to regularize it. And this often means that you have to employ a discretization. And if you have your discrete geometry, it's of course a question, what is your space of geometry? And there are several ideas in different approaches. Take, for instance, causal dynamical triangulation, where you just fix the edge length of your triangulation and you sum overall triangulation. And vector calculus, or quantum vector calculus, is the very opposite, where you fix your triangulation and integrate over the inner edge length, where your geometry still has to satisfy generalized triangle inequality. Or take, for instance, quantum gravity, where you have a generalized discrete geometric space. So, and a related question to that is, do we have to sum over all triangulations, like it is proposed by Hilbert series in causal dynamical triangulations, or do we have to sum over even more things, like all two complexes as in spin forms, or do we just need one fixed triangulation? And the reason why there are so many different ideas to this is that we have to understand better what is the relation between discrete and continuous geometry. And this relation is even further obscured by diffeomorphism. Because for our space of geometry, we cannot just take all the space of Kohn metrics. We have to obtain the quotient of the space of Kohn metrics with respect to diffeomorphism. In general, as I will explain to you in more detail later on, discretization in general breaks diffeomorphism. And to make my point more clear, I would like to go to the next slide, slide number three, where I would like to briefly mention a few ideas that have been around in literature for the measure in Euclidean vector calculus. In particular, Humber and Burgin have discussed the question of the measure in vector calculus very intensively. And for instance, we can take just the discretization of the formal continuum path integral, which is written here in equation number one. Where you integrate overall sparks, edge length, and you assign to each d-simplex the volume of the d-simplex to some power alpha. And this volume of the d-simplex is the natural discretization of the square root of the determinant of the metric. However, this factor alpha is a priori not known. And there have been also other ideas around, for instance, for a non-local measure, which is an idea by Reggie and Lund, in 74, but it is unpublished, where you do not assign the volume of a d-simplex to a d-simplex, but rather the square root of the determinant of the discretized Dirac supermetric. However, even this Dirac supermetric itself contains an ambiguity. So I would like now to tease you a little bit for the results I'm going to present you later on, because by requiring triangulation independence, we can fix this factor alpha to -1/2 and obtain a measure which is similar to spin form asymptotics. So let's go to the next slide, slide number four, where I want to give you the outline of my talk. First, I want to start with a motivation. Why do we consider triangulation independence at all? What is it, why is it reasonable to do so? Then part number two, I will explain the setting of my talk, which is linearized vector calculus. And then I go to the three-dimensional case, where we discuss the G2 and the small one Pachner move. when I go to the four-dimensional case, and there we discuss all three fundamentals, there's a small excursion to a mesh of scalar fields in two dimensions, and I will explain, it will become apparent when I am at that part of the talk why I do so, and then I will come to the conclusion and give a short outline on what are the interesting topics you should follow if you like this idea. So let's go to the next slide, which on which I will talk about the symmetries in the discrete. Because, as I mentioned already, in general, discretizations break the symmetry of this new theory. For instance, diffeomorphisms in general relativity. And just consider a very simple example as the one-dimensional parent-sized particle. So on the left-hand side, you see the case for vanishing potential. And I didn't draw any discretization points in here, because if you approximate derivatives and different quotients, you already capture the dynamics of the system. You can put as many discretizations, as many epitopes there, it will not change the results, and because you already capture the dynamics correctly, and you can even take the coarsest discretization possible, and even more, you can move around the vertices. However, on the right-hand side, if the potential is non-vanishing, your result depends very much on how many letter types you choose, where you put them. Then, for instance, you can take a very coarse discretization like the red one, and it captures the trajectory of the particle very badly. You can take a better one, the green one, and it approximates far better, but still it's not perfect in the sense that the symmetries of the continuous system are still broken in the discretization. However, if you go to the next slide, it is possible that you can construct a discretization which respects the continuous symmetry, which will be called a perfect discretization. For instance, Marston and West have done for the parametrized particle. And in the 80s, Humber and Williams considered that you calculate without a cosmological constant. And they realized in 3D, there's always a vertex sensation symmetry. And also in 4D, if the boundary data allow a net solution. And Benjamin Barr and Janka Liszt were able to extend this to that you calculate with a cosmological constant, where they didn't take flat syntheses, but constantly curved syntheses, which capture the dynamics in three-dimensional gravity, because with a cosmological constant, you expect a constant curvature in these spaces. And in the discrete, the diffeomorphism symmetries are realized by vertex inflation. And you can see this, or try to visualize this on the drawing below. And you make a subdivided tetrahedron, and the Ricci action actually does not depend on the position of the vertex inside the tetrahedron, so you can actually move it around inside, and it does not change your action of the system. And in that sense, you have less degrees of freedom. And we will see later on that we will also, if you discuss the 4-1 rule, for example, you will also see sketch eigennodes in the Hessian matrix. So please move to the next slide. Because I haven't explained to you why we consider triangulation independent and what this perfect civilization has to do with it. And therefore, I would like to refer to work I've done with Benjamin Barr and the younger Dietrich last year, where we discussed the discretized one-dimensional parametrized quantum harmonic oscillator. Yes, someone who's receiving a call here, I'm sorry. So for the one system, we came up with a Wilsonian renormalization rule procedure. So we fine-grained our discretization and integrated out these additional degrees of freedom and obtained an improved discretization. And it turns out that our system then flows towards a fixed point. And once you're at a fixed point, you are discretization independent. What was really interesting was that at the fixed point, we were actually reparametrization invariant. From the other side, if we started from a discretization invariant system, or I should rather say the system which is invariant under vertex inflation, we were already at a discretization independent. We had a discretization independent system. And I try to visualize proof in this drawing, because once you can move around your vertices in your discretization, you can actually move it on top of the other vertices, and then your additional cycle turns out to become a delta function, and you actually get the same amplitude with the coarser discretization. So, and in the sense I discussed here, the parameterization invariance is equivalent to the triangulation independence. And because of that, well, because you cannot expect to capture the dynamics of CR, especially in four dimensions, in any situation, we rather thought we could tackle the situation from the difference, from the other side, by requiring triangulation independence of our path integral. And that's why we consider triangulation independence. So please note the next slide, slide number 8. So how do you want to realize triangulation independence for vector calculus? And by triangulation independence, we mean that we want to assign the same path integral amplitude to different triangulations of the same manifold. And in 91, Udo Pachner discovered that triangulations, or if you have one triangulation of a manifold, you can obtain all other triangulations of the same manifold by a consecutive series of Pachner moves. And on this slide, I've shown you that two Pachner moves possible in three dimensions. I will explain them later on in more detail, but they are just local changes of your triangulation. So in this work, we consider just one of the Pachner components, like we call them, and the Quaglia invariance of the path integral under such a Pachner move. So please go to the next slide. Now I want to explain to you the setting of the source, which is linear vector calculus. So please go to slide number 10. So we would like to compute the path integral written down in equation number 3, which is we think our manifold has a boundary, and the edges which lie in the boundary are our boundary edges, and we want to integrate over all the edge lengths in the bulk, such that generalized triangle inequalities are satisfied. This means that the volumes of all syntheses and of all subsyntheses are positive, such that we restrict our integration to positive definite metrics. And we put in a measure function, a measure, mu of the which is a function of the edge length, an exponential of minus the edge reaction, which I've written down in equation number 4. And here you sum over all hinges in the bulk. Hinges are d minus 2 syntheses, and we actually have the volume of that hinge times 2 pi minus the sum over all d syntheses which contain that hinge and the dihedral angle in that syntax at that hinge. And for the bulk hinges, we summarize this for the bulk deficit angles, and for the boundary, we summarize these as exterior curvature angles called omega h boundaries. Please go to the next slide, slide number 11. And as I said before, usually this path integral has to satisfy the generalized triangle inequalities, which are, however, very difficult to implement in your path integral. So we try to circumvent this by perturbing around a flat background solution. So we take a solution of the Wechsler equation, which we call LE naught, and we will integrate over perturbation lambda e. And then we expand the action up to second order in lambda, where the term in the middle, the s by the LE, gives us the equations of motion for the HRE, written down in equation number 7. And note that in equation number 7, there is no derivative of the deficit angle because of the Schlaffy identity. And the key part of the talk is, or one of the key parts, is that we have to compute the Hessian matrix of the Wechsler action. So please go to the next slide, slide number 12. So we were interested in the three-dimensional and the four-dimensional case. In three dimensions, the situation is looks not that difficult. We have to compute the derivative of the deficit angles or exterior curvature angles with respect to edge length. In 4D, life is more difficult, but this will simplify later on, and I will explain this further. But the important thing is, what I marked here in red, is that you have to compute the derivative of the deficit angles with respect to edge length. So please go to the next slide, slide number 13. And Janka Dietrich the Hong Kong and Simon Satiana derived a formula for the derivative of dihedral angles in these syntheses, valid in any dimension. It's written down in equation number 10, where this theta tilde is means that you do not have, or you have the dihedral angle between the C minus 1 syntheses you obtain by one leaving out K and one leaving out L respectively. So don't, well, in particular in 3D, one tends to mistake or this theta tilde in three dimensions is not the theta at HKL, but is actually opposite of the HKL. So in fact, what we did first is use the formula and compute all the possible derivatives and group them together according to our geometry. And we obtained the Hessian matrix, but this is a very long and complicated calculation. And there's actually a shortcut. Because of from equation 10, we just need one k. If you divide by kl equals hn, then the formula shortens massively. And furthermore, we need the edge length variation under the condition that the d plus 1 volume of the Pachner complex vanishes. Such a Pachner complex consists of d plus 2 vertices. So in principle, it could span a d plus 1 volume. If we now require that the d plus 1 volume of the Pachner complex vanishes, this means it can be embedded into a Euclidean space of d dimensions. And this was actually a method introduced by Koropanov in 2000 and 2001. And we will use this, and or we will use this method by requiring that the bulk or that the deficit angles in our triangulation vanish. And we extended this method furthermore that we require that the exterior curvature angles are equal before and after the Pachner move. And this is I will not go into many details how to derive the formulas. You can find it in the paper, and it is a rather long and involved calculation. If you have questions, please don't hesitate to ask me about that. But from now on, I will rather present the results of our calculation. So please go to the next slide, slide number 14. Now I'm going to talk about three-dimensional electric calculus. So next slide, number 15. And we'll first discuss the 3-2 Pachner move. And please look on the left-hand side of your of the slide, because there's I've just drawn this, two tetrahedron configuration. You have two tetrahedra glued along the triangle 2, 3, 4, and you can turn this configuration into three tetrahedra by removing this triangle and connecting the vertices 0 and 1 by another edge 0, 1. So you have, in this case, you have one dimensional edge, 0, 1. And keep in mind that the Ricci equation for edge L, 0, 1 requires that the deficit angle as this edge vanishes. So L, 0, 1, naught, the background solution, is uniquely determined by the boundary data. So please go to the next slide, slide number 16. So for the Hessian, or the V2 move, with the ingredients I mentioned a few slides before, we have obtained the formula as written down in equation number 11. So the Hessian for the three tetrahedral configuration equals the Hessian of the two tetrahedral configuration plus this additional summand, which is the simple product of volumes and the simple function of edge length, times the sine, which depends on the geometry of the system. This VI bar denotes the volume of the tetrahedron, you obtain if you leave out the vertex I in your Pachner complex. If you go to the next slide, this is very back to slide number 15 for the Pachner move. For instance, by V naught bar, I mean the volume of the tetrahedron you obtain if you leave out vertex 0. So the tetrahedron 1, 2, 3, 4. So please go back to slide number 15. As I said before, this additional term, this is a simple function of volumes and edge length. And if you now solve the equation of motion for lambda 0, 1, so this single dynamical variable you have, and put it back into the action, you see that the action is actually invariant under the 3-2 move. So this additional term vanishes, and you're just left the halfing of the two tetrahedral configuration. Next slide, please. Now for the path integral, I've written down in equation number 12. We have just have one dynamical edge, so we just integrate over lambda 0, 1. We take a measure function, which only depends on the background edge length, and in the exponential, we write the Hessian matrix for the three tetrahedral configuration. And if we now integrate out edge 0, 1, we first see that this path integral C2 is proportional to the exponential function to the Hessian of the two tetrahedral configuration, and the measure is invariant. If you choose it such that you have product over all edge lengths in the numerator, and in the denominator you have a product over all tetrahedra, square root of the volume of the tetrahedra. And this actually agrees with Fontana-Reggi asymptotics. In fact, you could also assign this factor square root of pi to, or 1 over square root of pi, and to the tetrahedra of your triangulation, and could make it even more similar to Fontana-Reggi asymptotics. But actually, this factor is not determined by the Bachmann rules we consider here. Okay, this result is nice so far, but we also have to check if this measure is invariant under the 4-1. So please go to the next slide, number 18. Where we now discuss the 4-1. So on the left-hand side, you have one tetrahedron, 1, 2, 3, 4. And by adding, or by putting one additional vertex, 0, inside the tetrahedron, and connecting it to the other vertices, you obtain 4 tetrahedra, and you have now 4 dynamical edges, namely given by 0i, where I runs from 1 to 4. So in the path integral, you actually have to integrate over 4 edges now. But there are several obstacles. As I mentioned before, you have 3 categories of freedom. And this is rooted to the fact that the Reggi action does not depend on where you put the vertex 0 inside your tetrahedron. You can actually move it around inside, and this confirms the 3, and this will show up as an infinitesimal of, actually you have 3 possible directions where to move this around inside your tetrahedron, and therefore you have 3 categories of freedom. And furthermore, the dynamical node, so H0i, in your Hessian has the wrong sign, so it is negative, so the integral diverges. And this is known as the conforming mode problem, which goes back to the fact that the Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action is not bounded from below. And also, Gibbons, Hawking, and Perry encountered this in 78 in a continuous path integral formulation, and there they changed the path of integration accordingly, such that the integral converges, and it is the same thing. So using that, we go to the next slide, slide number 19. So if we now integrate our one edge and we use the same measure, mu of L, we obtain from the C2 move, we obtain this expression in equation number 16, where you see in the very front the same measure as before, the same measure function, just of the boundary edge length, over and 1 over the square root of volume V0. So this is the volume of the tetrahedron we had in the beginning. So this is correct. And in the exponential function, we are just left with the Hessian of the one tetrahedron configuration. What you are left with is integral over 3 more numbers, which can be interpreted as an infinitesimal 3D volume element. So we get fixed last to 1. And so to sum up the 4-1 move, we see that the action is invariant. We have 3 categories of freedom, which correspond to a 3-dimensional volume. So the 3-dimensional volume where you can move around your vertex accordingly, and the measure mu of L is also invariant. So please go to the next slide, number 20, where I now want to sum up 3-dimensional Reggi conflict. So the path integral as given in equation number 17 is triangulation independent, which is not that much of a surprise because 3-dimensional gravity isn't a topological theory. But the very nice thing is that the Hessian is of a very simple form for the FT-Bachmann rule, where F is greater than T, we have that the Hessian of the L configuration equals the Hessian of the T configuration plus the sine factor, a product of two edge lengths, and a simple quotient of volume of your geometry. And the invariant measure is given by mu of L, which is a product over an edge length over a product over all tetrahedra, the square root of the volume of the tetrahedra. And the amazing thing is, especially because we just considered linear theory, that this is the Fontano Zeche asymptotics. So, I think we should go on to four dimensions and see what we can do there with the same approach, with the same ideas. So, next slide, please, we should jump to slide number 22. And as you all know very well, life is much more complicated in four dimensions. So, you see that there are many more terms you have to consider. And even there are, of course, again, the derivatives of the deficit angles, but you also have to consider first and second derivatives of the areas of triangles. Well, actually, we only consider this red term here because, as I said before, we restrict our calculations to vanishing deficit angles. So the term in the middle does not appear. And the last term is about exterior curvature angles. We require that these are not changed by Tachmann, or they are actually not changed by Tachmann. And if we restrict to that part, the amazing thing is the calculations for the Hessian and the results are almost identical to the three-dimensional case. So please go to the next slide. We'll now discuss the four to Tachmann. So on the left-hand side, you have the two four-syndex configuration, where you have two syndices, two four-syndices that share one tetrahedron, 2, 3, 4, 5. And by removing this tetrahedron and introducing another edge, 0, 1, you obtain four four-syndices, and the two Tachmann roof, you have one dimensional edge, but now you have four five triangles. So they are these triangles that contain the edge 0, 1. And if you require now that the deficit angles at the bulk triangles vanish, this is a solution to the Zeche equation, not the only one. But if we require this, L01 is uniquely determined. And please go to the next slide for the 5-1 Tachmann roof. On the left-hand side, you have one four-syndex configuration. And by placing one additional vertex inside the four-syndex, you obtain five symmetrical edges, 0i, your I runs from 1 to 5, and you have 5 forces. And similar to the three-dimensional case, you can move the Zeche axiom does not depend on the very position of the vertex 0 inside the force index, so you can move it around and have 4 gauge degrees of freedom. And as in three-dimensions, h0i, 0i has the wrong sign, so you also have to perform a node problem, which we treated in the same way. So please go to the next slide, slide number 25, where I now give you the results for the S3 Tachmann roof for S square SMT. So very similar to the case in three dimensions, the Hessian of the S configuration equals the Hessian of the T configuration plus the sine factor. Again, you have a product of over edge length, and again, you have a quotient of volume of your configuration. But there is one important change. This factor D, I have written red in equation 21, is a non-local factor. I've given it in equation number 22. And in fact, it is the sum over volume times edge length squared. So this is the important change in comparison to three dimensions. And still, your action is invariant under these Tachmann rules. So if you solve for the edge 0, 1 and put in the solution, this additional term still vanishes. But of course, now we have a problem with our measure. And if we, first of all, ignore this factor D, our measure has almost the identical form as in three dimensions. It's again the product of all edge lengths over a funny factor. And then in the denominator, you have a product over all force indices, square root of volume of the force indices. However, we can make either the 4-2 move or the 5-1 move invariant in the path integral, which gets back to the question, do we assign a square root of D to the edges? or the symplices or the vertices of our triangulation. Of course, this can also make the question of invariance much more involved and much more difficult, and it is still not clear how to assign this non-local factor to part of our geometry. And the interesting thing is, well, please go to the next slide, where I take you into a small excursion into two dimensions for the massive scalar field, which is something Bianca discovered very recently. And in equation 24, I've given you the action, or I should also say Hamilton's principal function for the massive scalar field on a triangulation, where you have a similar behavior as before the UFG gravity, because the action is invariant energy through one move, not on the energy to two move, but in the Gaussian integration, you also obtain a non-local factor, which here looks very similar to the case before. And the actual form is not that important of that factor, but also here the question is, how do we assign this non-local factor to geometric quantities? It would be somewhat natural to assign it to vertices, but this makes the whole discussion of invariance much more involved and much more difficult. And also a different question arises, because maybe it is rooted to the fact that we have a background geometry in polyregi, and here we have a triangulation as our background geometry, and in polyregi gravity we just use the travel lounges, and here we have a massive scalar field on it. Maybe this problem is rooted to that fact, but it still needs to be investigated. So please go to the slide number 27. Now we already leave the two dimensions and go back to four dimensions of the gravity. Well, now present you the very peculiar three move. Because and this is a very different Fachmann move from all the others I've presented you so far, because here it defines no American edge at all. All of these edges are boundary. And the left hand, the two configurations are drawn here, they only differ by the triangle, the single side triangle which is shared by all three simplices. On the left hand side, the three four simplices share the triangle 0, 1, 2, which are drawn in green. And on the right-hand side, they share the triangle 3, 4, 5. So again, this configuration, which configuration you have, is only determined by the triangle, which is shared by all four simplices. And if you have, or depending on the boundary data you have, this may affect curvature. So you cannot always restrict to the case that part sector angle vanishes. So please go to the next slide, number 28. Well, now I want to give you the results for the three moves. Because for the Hessian matrix, what I think, I've written down here the difference of the two configurations. Again, almost the same formula, a sine factor, simple product of the two edge lengths and dispersion of volumes. And again, you have this non-local factor, d012. And in fact, d012 equals minus d345. Which is not in general, this is not zero. So what I also want to take home, the take home message here is that the Reggie action is not invariant analytically seamless. And this is not only the case in linearized Reggie gravity, which I described here, but it is also the case in the full theory, which was shown by Barn, an unpublished work where he was able to show that the difference of the passing in the two configurations actually grows quadratically with the deficit angle on the single side triangle. And of course, once the action is not invariant anymore, it is difficult to expect that the measure is invariant. So actually, our measure would only be invariant if the product of volume of our forcing is actually identical in both cases. And this is in general not true. So please go to slide number 29. Where I now want to sum up our results for 4D Reggie gravity. So the Hessian is again given in the form written down in equation 29. so the Hessian of the F configuration equals the Hessian of the T configuration plus an additional factor which contains a sine factor, this non-local factor D, and a simple product over edge length, and the quotient of volume. And as I've discussed already, the action is invariant under the 4.2 and the 5.1 list, but not for the 3.3. And this is true not only in the linearized, but also in the full theory. And the measure, up to factors of d, is actually given, is again given by a product over all edge length over the product of all eccentricities, square root of volume of the fourth integral. And again, the path integral up to the second non-local factor is invariant for the 4.2 and 5.1 move, and not for the 3.3 move. And as I mentioned before, you can either make the 4.2 or the 5.1 move invariant, but not both of them. And this goes back to the question, do we assign the factor B to vertices or edges, which will also make the situation much more complicated. So this is the next slide. I'm now come to conclusion and an outlook. So let's go to slide number 31. I now want to give you a summary. So our goal was that we wanted to have a path integral for vector gravity, which is invariant under which is triangulation independent. And we consider the case where the vector gravity is linearized around a flat background. We intensively use the condition that the deficit angles vanish. And in fact, we derived the Hessian in terms of simple geometric quantities. So yet again, the Hessian of the S configuration is the Hessian of the C configuration, plus this additional factor, we have the sine factor, the simple product of the edge length, and the proportion of volume. And this factor D is in fact one in 3 dimensions, but in 4 dimensions it is a non-local factor. Another important step is that the linear vector action is invariant for all Fachmann moves, with the exception of the 3D Fachmann moves in 4 dimensions. And the measure which is as invariant as possible is given by a product over edge length over a product over eccentricities volume of the decent, square root of volume of the decent x. Please go to slide number 32. I now come to a conclusion. So for 3-dimensional linearized vertical gravity, we have been able to obtain a triangulation-independent path integral. As I said before, this is not too much of a surprise since 3-dimensional gravity is a topological theory. But the amazing thing is, although we only considered the linear theory, the measure is similar to mechanical energy as in products in this case. However, for 4 dimensions, we have seen that there is a non-local factor, and yet the local part of the path integral is very similar to 3-dimensional gravity. However, we have no chance to compare this to 4-dimensional spin foam because there is no interpretation yet. But maybe our results can provide an interpretation for them, which would be very interesting. However, in 4 dimensions, the path integral is not invariant under all Fachmann moves. And in particular, the vector action is not invariant under the C3 move. But if you recall from the very beginning where I presented you several ideas for measures in vector calculus, there is always a situation that there is an ambiguity which is not clear or which cannot be fixed. Actually, triangulation independence fixes this ambiguity because in the idea by Humber and Williams, we would fix this factor alpha, which is in the exponent of volume of the decent length, to -1/2. And I think what also needs to be closer examined is the relation between a vertex sensation symmetry and triangulation independence. And because of that, I think it makes a lot of sense to take a closer look at triangulation independence. So please go to the next slide, slide number 33, for an outlook. And a very interesting example or a very interesting point where I would like to see this in the slide would be a spin form model which is invariant under the 5.1 limit. Because let's imagine the situation. You have this 5 force and place configuration. And take a look at the dual picture where you have 5 vertices and outside we have 5 edges outgoing. And imagine you sum over all the inner coloring and you obtain a new 5-dimensional vertex, which is a new, so to speak, modified decent length. And in that sense, you could come up with a renormalization group feature, which only works with a local coupling, and if you now achieve that the simple model is invariant in a zipf one loop, there wouldn't be no further subdivision if necessary or reasonable, because your four simplex is already invariant under subdivision. So in that sense, it could be the smallest local atom of space-time. And to even further establish a connection to spin foams, it would be interesting to take a look at first order the calculus, where when using angle area and angle analysis, which are sometimes closer to spin foams. And as was recently discovered by Zinyanka, it should be interesting to consider the scalar field on a triangulation, in particular the N1 loop, also in higher dimensions, from which one can probably learn how to deal with these non-local factors. So since I'm already finished talking, I would very much like to thank you for your attention.
Any questions?
Can I ask a question? This is a question really of outlook. How bad is it to demand triangulation independence in the four-dimensional case under the moves except for the 3-to-3 move? Because when looking at the picture slide 7, the 3-to-3 move doesn't look like it has any continuous analog. It looks more like a priority transformation, that is something which is a discrete transformation. So asking for an analog of diffeomorphism transformations might lead you to the conclusion that you need triangulation independence under the other moves, but not of this one, and perhaps even this one reflects some sort of parity non-invariance of the measure of the theory. These are just some first thoughts. I'm sure you've thought about this much more.
I'm sorry, I mean, do you think that one shouldn't consider invariant in a ZipF2 move, or
I'm wondering if there might be a case for being satisfied with invariance under changes of triangulation except for under the 3-3 move. And I gave two suggestions why one might think this is the case. One of them is that since this looks more like a discrete transformation than a discretization of a continuous transformation, maybe it's more analogous to a parity transformation than a diffeomorphism. And perhaps both for reasons of maybe it would be sufficient to require triangulation independence under the other moves, but not under this one.
Could be the case, but I personally think that the 3-3 move indicates that that reaction is still not the final answer. So one should still try to improve the discretization further, and I think then one can also achieve invariance under this thought. If one is able to find a perfect discretization for gravity, which is not very probable, but I think then one could achieve invariance under this theorem. But in that sense, I think this rather shows us that the retching action itself is not the final answer.
Sure. Let me ask ask a question. Parkner proved a theorem that said that you can get from any triangulation of a d-dimensional manifold to any other triangulation by a sequence of Parkner moves. So we can call that a kind of discrete ergodicity. If you consider four-dimensional triangulations, triangulations of four-dimensional manifolds, and consider whether you can go from any triangulation of a four-dimensional manifold to any other one just by the other moves, is there a possibility that in this case the 3-3 move is inessential so that you can still have the discrete form of ergodicity? Or if you don't have invariance under the 3-3 move, do the triangulations then fall into classes that you cannot get from one to the other through these classes? And if it's the second one, are these classes possibly related by parity transformations?
To be honest, I think the three-three move itself is also important because in this, let's consider this point situation, because we could have, for instance, boundary data for the three-three move, which require you to have curvature. So you could have, so you actually have can have situations with curvature there, and the Reggie, I think one should also try to achieve invariant energy three moves and maybe have possibly many different equivalent classes.
Okay, thank you.
Can I comment to that?
Sure. I expected that.
Sorry. Yeah, so to the first question, so we don't, I mean, we think that the 3-3 move is necessary to obtain all equivalence between all triangulations. And in a sense, as Sebastian mentioned, so the Reggie action is already invariant under the 4-2 and the 5-1. And there's really reason to believe that this is the only local form which is invariant under the 5-1 and 4-2. So the 3-3 would introduce non-local terms. If we want to have an action which is invariant under the 3-3, that would be only possible probably with an action which is non-local, if you want to have you know, degrees of freedom. And I don't think it's really a parity transformation. So actually all the orientations are, you can do a transformation such that all orientations are the same. It's not necessarily related to parity.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
This is Jonathan Engel at FAU. I have a question. You mentioned that this invariance, the invariance of the Reggie action only holds when it's linearized about a flat background. And then, but in the final outlook slide, you're suggesting that perhaps we should look for a spinful model invariant under the 5-1 move, and that no further subdivision would be necessary. But, I mean, you're not restricting yourself to being near flat in that situation, are you? So I'm not sure how you get from looking at linearization about a flat background to making conclusions about a full spin foam model where you're swimming over all possible triangulations and all possible spins and intertwines.
That was a philosophical question of whether or not you should consider triangulation independent. Of course, this is just our work is, of course, just linearized around the flat background, but also supposed to advertise the method that one should try to learn something from triangulation independence. So this is rather a very, very far on the
call. Yeah, but my point is that it seems you're suggesting that what you learned is that you should impose invariance beyond simply in the regime where you're close to flat. But I mean, it's clear that you expect to have these invariances when you're close to a flat geometry. That's not a surprising conclusion. But it's not clear to me why you would take that as a lesson for the more general case. It's not clear what justifies such a jump.
So I don't know if Sebastian is going to answer. Jonathan, to clarify, it's actually the full Reggie action which is invariant under the 5-1 and the 4-2. So it's not only the linearized Reggie action, it's the full classical theory which is invariant under these two moves. And it's only the 3-3, which is both non-invariant under the linearized, in the linearized regime and in the full regime. So from this perspective, it's actually not only in the flat regime in a sense, but for flat boundary data, which gives you this invariance.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
let us thank the speaker.